Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Stack Trace, this podcast that is all about life and technology from two developers' perspective. And those two developers are me, John Sundell, and my good friend, Mr. Guy Rambo. How's it going, Rambo?
Hi, John. Doing great.
Awesome. Are you recovering after WWDC now that we've had a little bit more time to kind of digest all of the news? We've had some time to play around with the betas, with the new APIs and so on.
Yeah, definitely. I've been living on beta for 2 weeks now, right? So yeah, it's been fun. Not on the Mac though, because I kind of need it to be perfectly working. So yeah, but on iPhone, iPad, all the good stuff. So been fun and definitely had time to recover.
Awesome. And what's your overall kind of feeling on the betas? Like, do they feel stable? Does it feel, let me phrase it this way. Does it feel like iOS 13 or like iOS 12?
This is definitely an iOS 12 year. Because the first iOS 14 beta has been surprisingly good for most people. And the second beta, which I have just installed here, so I haven't had much time to play with, but it felt like it wasn't any worse. And I think that's a good sign. Yeah. But yeah, and just keep in mind that this doesn't mean you should go and install it everywhere, because it's still a beta. There are bugs. Like, the most annoying one I was having with my device was the keyboard would freeze from time to time. So you're typing and then all of a sudden it just freezes. And then it like replays your touches after it comes back to life. So definitely still a beta, but it's pretty good.
That's awesome. I guess, like, what we're most looking for when we are kind of assessing the quality of a beta like this is, like you mentioned, there are always going to be bugs, and that's what a beta is for, right? To kind of, you know, find all the bugs, fix them, and to polish the software in general. But the overall stability is something that I think is good to take a look at. Like, does it feel like it's always crashing? Does it feel like there's a lot of rough edges? Or does it feel like something that they could reasonably work out within the next couple of months?
Yeah, definitely. It's been especially good this year for third-party apps. I feel like there aren't that many bugs affecting third-party apps, because it's very common with iOS betas for like some third-party apps to not even launch on the beta. And yeah. I haven't seen anything like that this year. There are some little bugs here and there, including in Chibi Studio, but nothing like major or show-stopping.
It also feels like Apple has, during the last couple of years, started prioritizing backward compatibility and source stability and things like that a lot higher than they used to. I kind of think that the whole transition from Swift 2 to Swift 3, you know, where everything was renamed, I feel like that has had some kind of lasting effect on their strategy and their approach. It feels like they are now favoring source stability really, really high. Like, that is a big priority. For example, we talked about it already with Swift UI, that Swift UI, all of the changes, and these are not small changes, by the way. Like, there's a lot of huge changes in Swift UI, but they're all additive. They're all maintaining the source stability from the previous iteration, from the previous year. And I feel like the same can also be said for a lot of other APIs as well, like a lot of the new UI kit stuff, the new collection view stuff. It feels like most of these things are all additive, and that is really, really impressive.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was me taking a picture of my Mac, which is updating here, because today is beta day, John. So I'm updating all the things, and I actually have my second Mac on verbose boot. So it's showing some logs there, and it's been in the same screen for quite a while, which has me a little bit worried. So I just took a picture just in case I need those logs later to file a radar. Yeah, nice. That's beta life right there.
It really is. So could we perhaps talk a little bit about the update process itself? Because I think one thing that a lot of people have noticed on Catalina, if we talk about the Mac specifically, is that updates, even incremental small updates to the operating system during the Catalina era, have been really, really slow. Like, sometimes it feels like I have to wait for like an hour for my computer to update. And I know I don't have the fastest computer on the planet, and that's fine. But it feels like the update process has gotten a lot slower. And I do remember that there was a lot of talk that in Big Sur, there's been a lot of improvements to the update process to make it faster and more stable. So Have you also noticed that? And could you perhaps talk a little bit about those changes?
Yeah, so like you mentioned, it doesn't have anything to do with your particular computer, I don't think, because my 16-inch MacBook Pro has had the same issue since I got it, basically. And I remember there was one particular update. I don't remember the exact version, but it took several hours for it to update. Like, it was like 3 hours or something. And that's just like my iPhone updates in 15 minutes. So it feels wrong for the Mac to take this long to update. And apparently, Apple is now using a similar update mechanism that they use on their mobile devices like iPhones and iPads on the Mac. So it's changing a little bit how that works. And I'm installing Beta 2 on my 13-inch MacBook Pro, which is my secondary Mac here, my Beta Mac. And it was a little bit different. It downloaded the update, which was quite large. But instead of just rebooting to install the update, it showed a progress indicator within the System Preferences app. And it was like preparing update and it stayed like that for like 10 minutes. And then it rebooted. And it's currently going through that process. So we'll see when it finishes here, if it does. I think that's going to be a lot better for people than the previous install process. And I actually think they're using one or some features of APFS. Like, they're applying the update to a secondary APFS snapshot of your system volume or something like that. And that's why they can do it while you're using your Mac, basically. And then later they reboot and apply that new update.
That's really cool, because that must be a huge benefit of something that I believe was introduced in Catalina, right? Where the system is now essentially running in a separate, not partition, but a separate like APFS volume, right? So it's read-only. And I believe that has been taken up a notch even in Big Sur, right? Like, now it's even like encrypted and things like that. And with having the system separated like that, it does seem like they could optimize things quite a lot, given that you haven't disabled that somehow, or, you know, you're fiddling around with the files. But then, you know, you're kind of already in dangerous territory if you're doing that.
Yeah, and actually the current process that seems to be going on is executing /system/library and a really long path, APFS seal volume. That's what Ooh. It's doing. It's sealing the volume, John. That sounds important.
Yeah, it does. It's sealing it, burying it underground, you know, and then throwing away the key. Oh, why would you have a key if you're just burying it underground? I don't know. Doesn't have to make sense.
Yeah, so that's what's going on right now. I'm really curious to see. Doesn't seem particularly faster, but with the caveat that this is a second beta and this machine is quite weak and it's almost full, its storage, so that could be playing a part in it being a little bit slower than it should.
Yeah, and now when you said that, I also realized that you're talking about basically my computer that I use every day.
I think yours is a little bit better because this is like the lowest of the low ends one.
Right, I did upgrade a CPU, so yeah, absolutely, that makes sense.
And how much memory do you have?
I have 16 gigabytes.
Yeah, I think this one is an 8 gig one, so it's quite a bit slower.
All right, cool. Really putting the non-pro in the non-pro laptop there. Awesome. So I have been taking a little bit of vacation now during this past week, actually. I tend to do this after WWDC, and, you know, it's kind of sometimes a bit challenging because I am very, very motivated and very excited to play around with all of the APIs. But, you know, WWDC is usually a very intense week for a lot of developers, and myself included, and we ran that WWDC by Sundell and Friends website during the week, and we posted a lot of articles, over 30 articles in 1 week, you know, all of us together, which is, you know, quite a lot. Yeah. So after WWDC, I usually just, you know, take a little bit of a breather and step away a little bit. And also it lets me kind of recharge and refocus and to think a little bit about what I want to start focusing on when it comes to all of the new APIs and things like that. So now I'm kind of slowly getting back a little bit to work here. And I'm going to start diving a lot more into all of the new APIs over the coming days, which I'm really looking forward to. And it's probably not going to be a big surprise, but I'm going to focus a lot on SwiftUI, at least to begin with, because there's so many new things in SwiftUI. And I have quite a lot of projects that I've been working on for the past year with SwiftUI, and I want to make sure to upgrade them. I want to make sure to see if I can really start taking them forward and eventually shipping some of them as well. So yeah, lots of exciting things to look forward to for me and for other people, hopefully, if I ever ship them.
Absolutely. Yeah, what I've been seeing like a theme this year, and not because there's something about SwiftUI this year that made it that way. It was already like that last year. But I think this year, many people are actually exploring SwiftUI more seriously, in a sense. And I've seen a bunch of iOS developers, very senior iOS developers, talking about how SwiftUI kind of brought the joy back into iOS development for them, that they're like tired of writing yet another UI table view implementation, and using SwiftUI is a breath of fresh air for them. And I think that's true for many people, including myself. Like, I've been doing a lot of SwiftUI stuff, mostly testing the new APIs, and it really is a joy to use. We all know its problems, and I'm kind of tired of "is it good for production" conversation, because I think it, as always, depends, but it really is nice to play around with.
Yeah, it really is. And I totally agree that it does bring back a lot of the joy of UI development, because it really kind of makes UI development how it, quote unquote, should be, which is that you have an idea for a UI that you want to build, and you can just take the minimum amount of steps to describe the UI that you want to appear on the screen to the computer, you know, using Swift, and it appears on the screen. Like, that is the ideal. And of course, SwiftUI does not, like you also mentioned, it does not always live up to that idea. It does not always accomplish exactly that. Like, sometimes you do have to dive in. Sometimes you do have to go back to UIKit or AppKit. Sometimes you need to work around limitations or bugs and things like that. But it's a young framework. We have to give it a little bit of time. But I think it has definitely had a huge improvement this year. And I think another thing that also makes a lot of people now willing to invest a little bit more time in learning it and things like that is that magical N-1 version number, right? Where there's going to be a lot of apps this fall when iOS 14 ships that is going to start requiring iOS 13 as their minimum version number, which means that they can't use all of the new APIs in SwiftUI, but they can use all of last year's APIs. And while, like I mentioned, there's been a lot of updates this year, what they shipped already last year, there's just so much there already. So you could already start adopting it in parts of your app, or, you know, to build new screens and things like that. So I just feel like there's a lot of excitement just because now people will actually be able to use it practically in a shipping app.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's true. And also, many of the things that were released last year got significant improvements this year that don't require iOS 14. Like, they're just better in general. And also, if you use it for something that wasn't on iOS 13, such as your widget or an app clip, then you don't even need to worry about that. So I think we're going to see some significant adoption of SwiftUI this year.
Yeah, I think so too. And also for me personally, over the last year, it has really reignited my passion or my interest in Mac development. Like, most of these projects that I mentioned that I've been working on, some of them are actually internal tools that I use myself every single day, or maybe not every day, but I use them all the time to run my company. I use them to create things like invoices. I use them for all sorts of automation. And these are all Mac apps like that I built using SwiftUI. And it's really, really fantastic for that, because I think we've discussed this many times before, but a Mac app usually uses mostly stock UI. And especially if you're building one just for yourself or as an internal tool, you're definitely just going to use like the built-in UI components. And SwiftUI is really great at that. Like, if you stick to built-in UI components, SwiftUI is usually really fantastic. It's like when you have custom behaviors or you want to really, really go in and make something really specific, that's when sometimes you can struggle with it and when you will have to go back to UIKit or AppKit. But for just like standard controls, it's usually really fantastic. Even the version they shipped last year.
Oh yeah, definitely. Just yesterday, I was writing another preference pane in AirBuddy 2, and I'm not using SwiftUI for that because I need to support, not that I need to, but I want to support Mojave. And I was dying, like, if only I could use SwiftUI for this, it would have taken me, like, it took me a long time to get that going, but yeah, I can't. But yeah, it definitely is really good to be able to use it. And I think we have even a question about this, so I'm going to talk about it later in terms of supporting iOS 13 or iOS 14. So we'll leave it for Ask Stacktrace.
Nice, a nice cliffhanger there.
Yeah.
But with that said, let's start moving into our In the News segment. But before we do, we don't want to thank a sponsor right now, but we want to thank one of our listeners, Jason Rookert, who participated in our Share Stacktrace. Can we call it a campaign, Rambo? Or should we call it, I don't know, a community effort to share Stacktrace, where we were giving away a mentorship session as a random prize. We picked a random winner who got invited to a mentorship session with me and Rambo. And that was Jason who won that. And we had that mentorship session with him before WWC, actually, but we just didn't have time to talk about it because we had so many things about WWC. But that was really, really fun. I really enjoyed doing that. And I think I can speak for both of us that we are looking into ways to do this more often than just once. We don't know yet how and when we can do that. And if you have any suggestions, you can feel free to tweet us. But I think both of us really enjoyed doing that mentorship session, to have that, you know, dedicated time to talk to one person and to discuss things, try to give some advice and things like that. So yeah, I just really, really enjoy that and hoping to do more of that in the future.
Yeah, same. I also kind of want to do it more. And it was so interesting that, first of all, Jason has a very interesting story, I think, as many people do. And I think I learned a lot in that hour that we talked to him. I don't know if you did as well, probably, but it's always fun when you do these types of things that you also learn, even though you're not there to learn necessarily. It's supposed to be the other person that's learning, but you also learn a lot.
Absolutely. And it's also really inspiring just to talk to someone, especially if it's like a listener, because I think we mentioned this before, but sometimes podcasting is a lot of fun, but it can sometimes feel like you are recording something, then you're putting it out there, and then there's just no feedback, right? Like, like people send us questions sometimes, but you know, whenever we hear from listeners, whenever people share our show and talk about it, whenever we get feedback, and whenever we get to actually talk to a listener like this, it is so inspiring for us, because it, you know, it makes us really feel like, well, someone actually listens to what we're saying, and that is really, really nice.
Definitely.
Awesome. So in the news, Rambo, what do we have this week?
So, John, I don't know if you've noticed, but when you buy an iPhone, I think you've done that like once in your life, right?
Yeah, once or twice. Yeah, right now we're like planning to hand down this iPhone from generation to generation. It's going to be the Sundell phone. It's going to be forever in the family.
Yeah, that's awesome. So, John, I don't know if you've noticed, but when you buy one, it comes with a few accessories. When you take the iPhone out of the box, there's this little like cradle where it sits in, and you take it out and there's more stuff underneath. You didn't throw that away, did you?
No, absolutely not. I have about 150 Apple stickers in my cabinet here. there's also, of course, headphones that come still with the iPhone, I believe. Did it even come with the iPhone 11 and 11 Pro headphones?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And there's also the charger, which I think is what you're getting at here, right? The charger.
Yeah, so the whole point of this diversion that I did was to talk about this story that's been doing the rounds lately. I believe the initial source was our good friend Minchi Kuo, good friend of the show. And apparently Apple will not be including a charger in the box with this year's iPhones.
Yeah, that's very, very interesting. I want to hear two things from you on this. The first is what you think about it. And the second is, why do you think Apple is doing this? But let's actually reverse those two. So could you first share your take on Why do you think Apple is doing it? Is it because they want to minimize e-waste? Is it because they want to save money or simplify the production or shipping? Why do you think that is?
Yeah, I was gonna ask if you wanted me to talk about why Apple will say they're doing this or why they're actually doing it.
That's a very good point. Let's actually have those three items then as discussion points. So what do you think Apple will say as the reason during the keynote?
If they talk about it during the keynote, and this is prime material for keynote poker, by the way, but if they do say anything about it during the keynote, it's definitely, I think it's extremely likely that it's going to be about the environment, that these generate a lot of e-waste. I think there is some research that's been done, and many people don't use them. And I'm kind of going into the other question already, but I personally, when I buy quite a few iPhones, and when I do, I just leave the charger in the box. I don't need it because I have so many already and they apparently never break. I've never had an iPhone charger break on me. I've had cables stop working, but not the charger itself. So basically, I never take those out. They stay in the box, and when I eventually give the phone away or sell it to someone, it goes in the box with the phone. So I think there is definitely an argument to be made about the environmental factors of distributing all of this stuff. There's also the fact that you could make the box significantly smaller if you didn't include the charger. And if you reduce the box size and you can, say, fit three boxes where you could previously fit only one box, that saves a lot in terms of, like, you, instead of having to ship it in three airplanes, you can ship it in two, in one airplane. So I think there is definitely an argument, and it wouldn't be like, they wouldn't be lying if they said that it is better for the environment. So that's what they're going to say if they say anything. What I think the initial reason for them doing it, I don't like to like assume intents on actions by people or companies, but it would definitely be the cost aspect for them. I think that would be like the first reason. Not that there aren't people at Apple and Apple as a company doesn't care about the environment. I believe they do. They truly believe that. But I think the initial motivation would be these things are expensive for us to make and we need to keep our 30% or whatever margin. So let's just not ship the charger in the box.
And that's not something that would be strange either. Like, I'm sure that there's a lot of people at Apple who have it as their primary job to minimize costs in the supply chain, right? Like, this is not something simple that, you know, Tim Cook is drawing up on his iPad Pro. Like, here's how we do it. Like, this is a very, very complex machinery. And the decision to include a charger or not, that's going to be a complex equation. And I'm sure that they're looking at statistics, like you say, like how many people actually use the charger that we ship. And if not enough people use it, and we can just sell it as an accessory, maybe not even with that much profit. Like, maybe they can reduce the cost of the phone, or maybe they can add more parts and keep the same price. Like, you know, that would work out. And then people who need a charger can just buy it as an extra accessory. Like, I'm sure that there's a lot of different data and variables that went into this decision. I mean, we don't even know if it's going to be a decision yet, but if it is. And I think it's pretty nice. I think there's going to be a lot of people who buy iPhones not as the first phone they ever buy, right? Like, that they're upgrading from a previous iPhone. And like you also mentioned, they have chargers already. Even I, and you joke that I never buy new iPhones. I'm still rocking the iPhone 10. But I also have lots of chargers like lying around the house. Because even if you just buy five iPhones, you have five chargers, right? And you don't need five chargers. You maybe need like one or two. So yeah, I think that this is a probably going to be a good decision overall for the cost saving on Apple's part. I mean, Apple can always make more money, right? That's always good for them. But for the environment, I think that's a very good reason.
Yeah. An option that I thought about when these stories started to come out was that maybe, I don't know, maybe, I'm not talking about Air Power 2 here or anything like that, but what if Apple is working on a wireless charger? Maybe it's like one of those simple ones that you put just one device on it. Or maybe they want to offer different options for chargers and they would do something like they do with the Apple Watch, where you can select your watch and then you select your watch band, and they are not in the same box. They're grouped together with like an enclosure, but the watch box is separate from the band box. Maybe they will do something like that. Like when you go to buy your iPhone, you can select if you want the slow charger, the fast charger, or the wireless charger.
Right. Almost like customizing a Mac, right? Like mm-hmm. which CPU do you want or how much RAM do you want? Yeah, that would make sense. And also, the wireless charging aspect here also I think is really important, where I primarily charge my iPhone these days with wireless charging. Like, it's very rare that I actually plug it in. The only place where I really plug it in is in my car. Like, when I charge it overnight and when I charge it at my desk, it's all using wireless chargers. So that's another reason not to ship it in the box, because probably they wouldn't include a wireless charger in the box, just like how they don't include AirPods in the box for headphones.
Yeah, and they could also be preparing people for this fully wireless future when the iPhone has no parts at all, which is a rumor, but it's not for this year. It's supposed to be only for next year. So then it wouldn't make sense at all for it to come with a charger, and they wouldn't like give you away a free wireless charger. That doesn't sound like Apple.
No, it really doesn't. And I was joking there before that it's good for Apple that they can make more money, and that's definitely something that they always like to do. So you can always bet on Apple doing something that's going to make them more money. They've gotten really good at that the last couple of decades. I don't know if you've noticed that, Rambo, but they've gotten, I would say, probably the best in the world at making money.
I think so. Yeah. I think they know how to do it. Yeah, we'll see. I think this is really interesting. It's an interesting discussion. I can't wait to find out when they talk about it or not during the keynote.
Yeah, same here. I think it's going to be interesting. And, you know, for me, it feels just like I don't have a strong opinion either way. If I get a free charger, I will just leave it in the box like you. But I will also just like, if it doesn't come with the charger, I won't be disappointed. And I do also appreciate the environmental aspects here. So yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what's going to happen.
Yeah, my personal opinion as well is that I don't care, really. Like, for me, it right. doesn't really matter.
So we just spent like 15 minutes talking about something that we don't really care about. But it's interesting to speculate. It's always interesting to speculate.
Yeah.
All right, but now let's segue into our next segment, which is going to be our deep dive. And on this week's deep dive, we want to talk about state management in Swift UI. So this has been a topic lately in the Swift community around how should you manage your state in Swift UI. There are many different tools at our disposal at developers for doing state management, and it can sometimes maybe feel a little bit confusing, or you don't really know which one you should pick in which situation. So I thought that this could be an interesting thing for us to discuss here on the show and to just go through the various mechanisms that we have for state management in Swift UI and talk a little bit about maybe which of these are good in which types of situations. And this is also something that I wrote my latest weekly article about state management. I wrote a guide to state management in Swift UI. So I thought that this could be like the podcast version, or the like director's commentary with you as well here on the show. What do you think, Rambo?
I think that's great, especially because I kind of need to learn a little bit more about that. So I can't wait to hear it directly from you.
All right, let's go. So let's just first start talking about why state management is different in Swift UI compared to other frameworks. Frameworks like, for example, UIKit and AppKit, Apple's previous UI frameworks, didn't really have a super strong opinion on how you manage your state. Sure, there were state management mechanisms built in. For example, the UI table view data source or UI collection view data source, where you take your data and bind it to your views. But how you actually stored your data and stored your state, how you made sure that your view got updated, how you passed that around between different views, and how you attached observations, or if you use delegates, or how you kind of communicated between your different views and passed actions and state along, the framework didn't really have any opinion on that, right? Like, there wasn't any, here's how you do it, and you basically can't do it any other way. And while Apple has been shipping core data for years now and other kind of data-related tools and ways of communicating with Notification Center and all those sorts of things, there was so many different ways you could do it in UIKit. And that is very, very different in SwiftUI, where SwiftUI, I guess you could do it in a completely custom way, but it definitely has a very strong opinion on how you manage your state.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's actually a good thing, because when you were teaching people about writing iOS apps in UIKit, eventually you'd always see this question, so should I use delegates? Should I use data sources? Should I use Notification Center or callbacks or key value observing? And the answer used to be all of them, right? And and also the best one, it depends, which it depended on which situation we were talking about. But the it depends of UIKit was a lot more broad, I think, than the one in SwiftUI, because I do think, and correct me if I'm wrong, that SwiftUI, you can actually answer that question a little bit better in terms of when you should use one versus the other.
Yeah, absolutely. And a core thing here also is that the framework actually ships with state management mechanisms. So you mentioned a couple of ways there of managing state in UIKit, like take observers, for example. Like, UIKit doesn't include a like UI observer manager, right? Like, if you wanted to implement observations in UIKit, you had to do it yourself. Like, you wrote your own observation protocol, for example, your own observation registry, and then you just wrote it for your use case, or you tried to make something reusable. While in SwiftUI, it already ships with a number of different mechanisms that you can use that are built in that you don't have to implement yourself. So I think that is also a very, very key difference between the two.
Yeah, definitely. It ships with high-level things that you can use out of the box, while with UIKit and Foundation, you usually had to create your own wrappers. And I've actually done that in a project of mine, where I wrote like an observation thing that was actually based in Notification Center, but the object would create its own Notification Center for its observers.
Nice.
Yeah, that was quite fun. So, John, tell me about the options, because I'm still a noob when it comes to SwiftUI, way more than you, probably. I kind of get confused sometimes when I'm working with it, especially this year, because they introduced the new state objects wrapper. When should I use one or the other in this case?
All right, so let's start from the beginning and talk about state, because state, I feel like it's like the very core API that you will use when it comes to view-based state management in SwiftUI. So all of the mechanisms that SwiftUI ship with are property wrappers. So for state, for example, you add at state to a property, and that becomes a state property that, when changed, will cause your view to re-render and update. So whenever you have private state that is internal to one view, then you typically would use state there. So here we're talking about, for example, let's say that you have a shopping cart, and in the shopping cart, you can increment and decrement the amount of one product that you want to buy. So you have, for example, a list of products, and then there's a little stepper next to each product. That stepper would probably be connected to a state variable, which would be an integer in this case, like amount of product, for example, right? So it will be internal to that view. And then when the user presses done, for example, then all those values will be collected and sent off to the network or something like that. So when you have something that is internal to one view, you will use state. And a guidance there is to keep those properties private, because they should be just internal to that one view. But then you might want to pass that state along to a subview, for example, but then you're still within the same view technically, right? Or the same view hierarchy, at least.
Yeah.
So for example, if you have a view that then wants to add a subview that can mutate that parent view state, then you can actually pass that state property as a binding. So that subview will declare an at binding property. And then from the parent view, you can pass in any state property into that binding using a dollar sign and the name of the property. So what you're doing there is that you're actually creating a mutable connection to your parent state. So if we take that stepper example again, let's say we're building a row in that shopping cart UI. So you will have like a product row. And then maybe you feel like the stepper part should actually be its own little UI component. Then you separate that out to a separate view. And then that component will accept a binding to an integer that will be the product count or the amount. And then the parent view can pass that state variable that it has into that stepper component, if that makes sense.
Yeah, the way I look at it, I might be wrong again, so correct me, but your views are structs in Swift UI. They don't have to be, but they, by convention, they are structs. So they're value types. So you, it would be really weird if you mutated your view anywhere, like randomly in all over the place. So the way I look at state is as if you're turning just one property of your view into a reference type so that you can mutate it without messing up your struct. That's how I think about it. And a very common example of that is you have a button and the button will present like a sheet or something, and you have a state property, which is private, which is a Boolean, like is presenting sheet or something like that. Would that be a good way to look at it?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, that's kind of how it's implemented under the hood. I mean, I haven't read the source code. Apple haven't been that kind that they have shared the source code with me for Swift UI. But you can kind of figure it out that somewhere what's actually happening is, like you mentioned, each view is a struct, which means that it doesn't have any identity or lifecycle. It's just a description of a view. But when you are using state or binding or any of these other property wrappers, somewhere there's like a reference being created internally in the framework to keep track of that state, right? So the framework keeps track of your view. It makes sure that it gets re-rendered and it observes that state. And when the state changes, it recreates your view. So it does all of that for you. So you don't have to manage any of that yourself. You just declare an at state or an at binding, and then the frameworks take care of the rest, which is a huge part of the appeal of Swift UI.
Yeah, exactly. Because from the point of view of your view, it's destroyed basically every time it's re-rendered. Of course, that's not what's actually happening necessarily, but you can treat it like an ephemeral thing. It's just a description, like you mentioned. So it's gonna describe your view, and when it changes, it all goes away and comes back as new. But your state is preserved.
Exactly. And that's really, really important. And that's a huge difference between Swift UI and Apple's previous UI frameworks, where, you know, there was a lot of tendency in the old days, especially like if we rewind the clock a couple of years ago, there was a lot of people putting a lot of logic inside of their view controllers and their views, like very, very close to the UI layer. In Swift UI, that is really, really, really discouraged. I mean, it's been discouraged for a while, even in UIKit and AppKit. But here it's almost impossible to write UI code that way, like to put a lot of logic inside of the views, because they are just these lightweight descriptions. And this kind of segues us nicely into the next mechanism for managing state, which is observed object and observable object. So that enables you to connect those view descriptions to a custom object that you have implemented where your actual quote-unquote business logic lives. So an observable object is really just any class, any reference type, any object that conforms to the observable object protocol. And what that means is that it can have properties on it that are marked with yet another property wrapper called @published, where if you have a published property and that changes, then it does the same thing as those state and binding properties that we talked about before, where that triggers an update in your view if one of those views observes your observable object. So in the view, you can declare that I have an observed object here and it's a variable, and it can then point to one of those observable objects and make that same state connection. But this time, the actual state is not stored in your view. It's stored somewhere else as a reference type, and you are just referencing it. So for example, if we're talking about a database, you might have a database object that is observable object. And you can inject that database into any number of views that you want, and they can then observe it. And then anytime the state of the database changes, those views will automatically be updated.
Yeah, that's really cool. And what's even nicer about observable object is you mentioned you need to conform to it, but you actually don't have to do anything most times. You just declare that your reference type conforms to observable object, and you put published properties inside of it, and that's it. That's basically it. You can do more if you need to do something more manual, but the gist of it is that you don't actually have to do anything for the conformance to happen.
Exactly. And that is true for so many aspects of Swift UI, where they are leveraging the fact that the framework has that strong opinion that we talked about earlier to give you really good defaults, right?
Yeah.
So in so many places, you can type very little code and actually get a default behavior, which you can then override. Like, you can dig in and implement your own publisher using combine for your observable object if you want to, but most implementations probably won't. They will just like contain the logic, they will have some published properties, and they will then update those properties, and that will be the observation, right? So I think that is super, super nice. And I mentioned here that this is for external objects that are external to your view hierarchy, and that's really important to emphasize here, because when we're talking about observable objects, those should, in general, be implemented as outside and external to your view layer as much as you can. So I would really recommend not putting too much like Swift UI specific things in your observable objects, but rather try to keep them completely separate from the view layer. And if you do that, you kind of end up with very nice separation of concerns automatically, right? You don't have to go through a ton of effort like splitting your view controller up, for example, into logic controllers or view models and things like that. You kind of get the separation already from the framework, where if you keep your observable objects kind of not too concerned with the UI itself, but they just publish properties with data, and then your views can then consume that data, that is just a nice separation in general.
Yeah, I would say you shouldn't have anything Swift UI at all in your observable objects. It should only import combine, and that's it. Observable objects are also a very good way to wrap APIs that are not offering you a combine-friendly way to access their things, basically. So if you have even like an Apple system framework or an external dependency or some sort of database you're using, and it doesn't offer an observable object that you can use directly, it's very easy to take something that's based on delegation or closures and just create a thin wrapper that's an observable object. I've done that many times when working with SwiftUI, and when you have to interface with, quote, the old way of doing things, creating a simple wrapper that's an observable object and it publishes properties is very simple to do.
Yeah, exactly. It's really, really powerful. And again, because you get so much of that conformance for free, it's, like you mentioned, it's usually very easy to do. You just have to add conformance and add a few published properties and you're done, which is really, really nice.
Yeah.
So that's observable object. An observable object can either be consumed in a view as an observed object. So it's observable and observed, right? But then there's also this new property wrapper that you mentioned earlier, state object. And what's the difference then between an observed object and a state object? Well, the difference is really around ownership. So when you have an observed object, that is, like we talked about, injected from elsewhere. So your view does not own this object. It just gets it injected, for example, in its initializer, and it observes it. And when you have that relationship between two objects in your code base, an observer and an observable, those usually, or I would almost go with always here, have a relationship where the object that is observing the other object never owns that object, right? Usually, if you would have that pattern in UIKit, for example, or in another framework, you would make that a weak reference, right?
Yeah.
Because otherwise, you would often end up with retain cycles, because your object that can have observers attached to it usually has to hold on to those observers somehow, right? And then it's kind of strange if also the object that is doing the observation also holds on to that, because then you can have a retain cycle. So this is maintained in Swift UI, where if you are observing an object, there's no guarantee that if a view owns that object, that it will remain in memory. It can be released, because you talked about this earlier, Swift UI will sometimes destroy and recreate views on your behalf. For example, if you have a list and you have different rows in that list, as those rows get deallocated and reused as they go off screen, they could be completely destroyed. And if you have then an observed object in there as a reference, with a view as the owner, then that could just be destroyed, that object, and then you would have that recreated, which might not be what you want. So whenever you have an observed object, you should store that somewhere else. That should be retained by another object and just observed by your SwiftUI view. While state object, on the other hand, is the opposite, where state objects provides you with a way to reliably say this view owns this object that is also observing, and SwiftUI will make sure to retain that object in memory to make sure that there's, at least as far as SwiftUI is concerned, no retain cycles, no memory leaks and things like that. And if it destroys your view and then recreates it, it will make sure to assign that same instance of that state object back to the view so that there's no accidental releases of objects.
Yeah, so with this description, I think it's fair to say that state object will be a good fit if you need to abstract away some of your view logic into another object, and you are doing that for the view itself. Like, it's not like a view model that would be passed into your view from somewhere else. It's something that's very specific to the workings of that specific view. So that view should actually own that state.
Yeah, exactly. And another very common use case for this, I think, will be, and I think this is primarily actually why Apple introduced it, is that SwiftUI can now be used to build entire apps.
Yeah.
So your root object in your view will not be like an app delegate or something that can hold these observable objects or act as a dependency container. It will be a struct. Like your app will be a struct which follows the same rules. Like, it will typically probably not be destroyed, I don't think, because you will probably just have one instance of your app, but it's still a value type. So it would kind of be strange to have that be an owner of a reference type, the only owner of it. So that's why typically if you create a SwiftUI only app with that app and scene API they introduced this year, you will probably use state object in those objects to keep track of your root databases and your root kind of core logic objects.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But I think in terms of guidance, like at least from my perspective, and again, like I saw state object for the first time when it was introduced as WWDC, but I think it's fair to say that if you're looking at guidance of when do I use observed object versus when do I use state object, I would say if you're injecting the object from elsewhere, use observed object. If your object is owned by the view itself, use state object. So it's kind of like the same difference between state and binding, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where binding gets passed in from elsewhere into your view and state is private to your view. Same thing here. State object is private to your view. It's created by the view itself versus observed object is something you inject into your view. I would say that is how I would look at it, at least.
Sounds good. And then we have environment object, right? Which is usually used with an observable object, but I think its primary purpose is to do dependency injection, right?
That's right. It's a way to attach an object to an entire view hierarchy. So SwiftUI uses this internally quite a lot. So you might have noticed that you can assign a font to a root view, and then that font will just appear in all the child views, right? Or you can do the same with the accent color or the text color and all sorts of different modifiers. And that's because they get assigned to the environment. So if you want to do the same thing with your own custom object, say, for example, you want to have an error handler or a networking manager or whatever you want to call it, or database like we talked about, and you want that to appear in your entire view hierarchy, you can put that in the environment, and then any view downwards, like any subview from the view where it was put in the environment, can then access that directly without having to have it directly injected. And what they're trying to avoid here in terms of the design of the framework is it's very common when you do dependency injection where, let's say, you have five objects in a hierarchy and the fifth object needs an object from the first object, right? Then it has to be passed down the whole chain. And yeah, that can be really tedious and annoying. And there are ways to get around it. But SwiftUI here, again, has an opinion, provides a built-in way to do that, to say you can put it in the environment and then any subview can then access it using the environment object property wrapper.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite things about SwiftUI because I am a fan of dependency injection. But like you mentioned, it can be a little bit tedious to do, especially if you don't want to use a dependency, just as I usually do. It's one of my favorite things.
Yeah, me too. And then the question is, when would you use environment versus observed object, right? So there's this decision matrix here. Like, there are all these different mechanisms for managing state. What's your personal take on this, Rambo? Like, when would you opt for putting something in the environment versus injecting it directly using observed object?
What I've been doing, which again could be wrong, is that I use observed object when it's like a one-off type thing, like it's only going to be used in that particular view, or it's only a dependency of that one view that I'm working on. And I use environment object when it's something more general that, like you mentioned, like a database or some sort of provider that's going to be needed in several different views in the hierarchy.
Yeah. I think that's a good approach. And another thing you can also consider here is that you can have a parent view that gets injected with an observed object, and then it just recreates the whole view hierarchy underneath it. So it doesn't pass that observed object along, but it just passes values down, right? And that might seem initially that could be very inefficient because you would have to redraw the entire view hierarchy every time something changes in the data. But SwiftUI is actually really efficient when it comes to these things. Like, again, because they're just structs and it has a type-based kind of diffing algorithm that is very, very efficient. So those things can actually be way faster than you might think. And it can even be faster than having a lot of observed objects because that also adds overhead. So there are many different ways to go here.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I think that's a pretty good overview of, if I may say so myself, that's at least an overview of all of the different mechanisms that we have at our disposal. So state and binding are for keeping tracks of values, where you either have it private in a view, and then binding means you can mutate it, you can pass along a mutating connection to that state. Observed object and state object are for reference types for classes. And observed object is when you are injecting an object, and state object is when your view owns it. And environment is when you want to add something to an entire view hierarchy, not just to one view. So that hopefully gives our dear listeners some kind of idea on when to start with all these different things and to kind of create a little mental mind map of when to use which.
Yeah, definitely. I'm probably going to be referring back to this episode if I need extra guidance.
Awesome. Cool. So that was fun. Always fun to do a deep dive. And often, Rambo, it's you who kind of have all the knowledge when it comes to these things because you've been spelunking something or you know how something really works under the hood. So I'm glad to have provided a little bit of extra context here during this segment as the Swift representative of the two of us.
Yeah, you're the Swiftiest one.
That's perfect. But what do you say? Should we round off this episode by doing some Ask Stacktrace?
Absolutely.
All right, let's do it. And let's kick it off with a question from Sean. And Sean wants to hear, as we go through WWDC 20 and all the announcements that Apple made, it would seem like extensions are getting more and more important. So what would be a good reason to modularize a code base into frameworks versus just sharing resources between multiple targets? And this is something that we talked before about, and I know that, Rambo, you are very passionate about this. But even though you are maybe a little bit biased towards the framework approach here, what would be your kind of general way of thinking when it comes to deciding whether just to include a file in multiple targets versus actually creating a framework for it?
I'd say if you have an app that doesn't currently have things separated into modules or frameworks, whatever you prefer to call them, and you want to, say, have a notification extension, for instance, you don't need to create a framework just to share stuff between that and your app. I think you can be pragmatic in that case and just check the target membership for the particular files that you need. I think that's not a problem necessarily. But when you start adding more and more different types of framework targets and more things start adding up, that becomes quite a mess really quickly, especially if your project is more complicated and has more stuff in it. It starts becoming a bit of an issue to manage the membership of different files in different targets. And also when you do that, you don't get another benefit of separating things into multiple frameworks, which is separation of concerns and also reusability. You also, you can, but it becomes more messy to like have separate build configurations between different targets. So I would say start modularizing your codes right now before it's too late. And if you just need to ship that, extension real quick, then just check the target membership. It's not going to kill you. But yeah, I think that that's the pragmatic response.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. And I would also say that if you're working on an extension and you're learning that new API, for example, if you're learning how to create a widget, also adding on top of that modularization, if you haven't done that before, can just turn a task which is manageable, which is learning the new widget system, which is already big in of itself, yeah, and then adding another huge task and making it a monumental task. And I am making this mistake myself all the time, where I have something I need to do and I just make it grow so much in scope because I also want to now refactor the code, or you know, I want to extract something into an open source library or something. And this is something I have to stop myself from doing time and time again, where let me just get this one thing done and then I can worry about the other thing. So I think you're absolutely right in saying that be pragmatic. And if you just need a couple of files to implement your extension, then yeah, absolutely add those targets. Just check the checkbox, right? That's the theme of iOS development these days. Just check the checkbox. But keep track of it. Like, don't just check that checkbox and forget about it. Like, try to remember to add to your task management system to actually follow up on this and to see, okay, if I have these three files that need to be shared between my app and maybe a few different extensions, maybe it's your database code, maybe it's your model code, your networking code, something like that, then those are great candidates for moving into a framework. And like Aram also mentions, there's a lot of benefits to doing that apart from just being able to share the code itself, right? You can even use like the internal access modifier. So you can separate your objects out and have internal classes that are only within that framework. And that way you can create a nicer architecture without having the API become huge, right? Or complicated. So there are many different approaches here and pros and cons. But I would say also, I would agree with, try to get the thing you need to get done first, but don't just forget about the things you did, but then actually make note of them and try to follow up and refactor afterwards.
Yeah, and another thing that's a huge advantage of frameworks that I almost forgot to mention here is that you don't duplicate stuff in terms of actual like bytes on disk. So if you have a lot of stuff, usually, let's say you're going to need your networking layer in your app extension, and that's implemented in like a bunch of Swift files or something. Then you're going to check those files into your notification extension. Your notification extension is embedded with your app. So now you're duplicating the amount of bytes that the code takes. And it might not be a lot depending on how much you're sharing between them using the target approach. But it adds up, especially if you need to also share assets like your asset catalog. It can become huge, like you're going to be duplicating a lot of code and assets between your app and your extensions. And if you add like a second extension and a third, it can grow exponentially from there if you don't use frameworks. Because when you embed a framework, you embed the framework in your app target and your extensions will link against the framework that's embedded in your app target. So you only embed the code and assets once.
Yeah, that's a very, very good point. And another thing also that can happen here, like for example, if you choose to go with the pragmatic approach that we called it, like adding files to that specific target just as a kind of temporary workaround, chances are that the number of files you will need to add can grow quite rapidly, where you might think, okay, I just need my networking code here. Okay, I just need to download a JSON file from my server in my widget, for example, and render it in my widget, and that's going to be it. So you include your networking.swift file. However, that file needs to know about your model layer. So then you include your model file. And then that needs to know about something else, et cetera, et cetera, right? And then all of a sudden, you've added almost half of your app into that extension. And the duplication issue arises, and also just the overhead and complexity that comes with that. So that is a great point. Like if you find yourself doing that, that should also tell you, I think, that maybe something can be improved here with your architecture in terms of separation of concerns. Like if you start pulling one thread and you get the whole ball of yarn out on the other side, that typically means that you have something that needs kind of untangling there in the middle. So if you do have a lot of interdependencies like that in your code base, this can be actually a very good motivation also to kind of disconnect some of those and to create better abstractions using something like a framework.
Yeah, and I totally understand that it's not like an easy task, especially for complicated old apps. Like, we're still in the process of doing that at the job. Like, we've come a long way. We're almost at the point that it's like perfectly modularized, but we've been doing it for like 3 years. So for a large app to get it fully modularized and have everything separated, it can take a really long time. So start small. Like, we started, I think, with like a kit framework that we made that was like a few shared view things and our networking code and things like that. And then you slowly separate things out into multiple frameworks. It can take a long time for a complex app.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's no shame in that. Like, yeah. I'm a huge fan of those kind of long-running projects where you can keep shipping your app at the same time, but you have some kind of vision for where you're headed. I like to call it a North Star, where you have your North Star, you know you want to get there, you want to modularize your app, but it's going to take you some time, but that's fine, because then you have like a guidance for your team, like, here's where we want to go towards. But we can still keep shipping. We don't have to, you know, take 6 months and rewrite the whole thing, and then maybe later it will be better. But we will still have bugs, only different bugs. So I'm a huge fan of those kind of incremental moves towards a better architecture.
Yeah, I also want to mention that in the App Clips sessions at DubDub this year, when they show like how to add parts of your app to an app clip, they show the checkbox approach with like adding the same files to another target. That doesn't mean that Apple is recommending that you do it that way necessarily, but there are two things to keep in mind there. First, it's a WWDC session, so they don't have time to like explain frameworks, and they just do it in the easiest way possible. And also, app clips are not an extension. They are an actual app. So they're a separate app. So in that case, some of the issues that we mentioned don't apply, because it's actually a separate app.
Right. Yeah, that's a very good point. And I also think that point you just made there around it being like a demo, it being a session focused on something else, it's so incredibly important.
Yeah.
Like, this is something I run into all the time when I'm writing an article, for example. I can sometimes feel like I'm contradicting myself in terms of what I've written about the past week and what I'm writing about now, because I'm not maybe using the pattern that I was talking about last week in this new article, because it's not about that, right?
Yeah.
And that is something that I'm sure Apple is struggling with as well, where, like you also say, like, if you're going to use frameworks, you have to explain what it is, because you can't just assume that everyone watching, someone might just have started watching this video to learn about app clips for the first time, and you can't just assume that they have all of this other knowledge, right?
Yeah.
So I have the same thing with my articles, where sometimes I will go for an approach in the article that is maybe not my ideal way that I would do it in a production app, in terms of something else that the article is not about, like something tangential. But, you know, sometimes you just have to do that for simplicity.
Yeah, definitely.
Cool. So let's round off this episode now with the last question for this week, at least. And this one comes from Kevin. And this was the cliffhanger. We're now going to climb up from the cliff that we've been hanging on for the whole episode, Rambo. Finally, we can climb up. And Kevin asks, iOS 14 supports all devices that iOS 13 supports, which is awesome. Kevin did not say that. I said that. It's really awesome, but I'm sure Kevin agrees. Would you update the required iOS version for a given project? So for example, Rambo, say that you have an app that currently requires iOS 13. Would you say from now on it actually requires iOS 14 when iOS 14 ships, given that everyone running iOS 13 can theoretically run iOS 14?
That is the million-dollar question. Sometimes literally.
Yeah, that's true.
So again, like, it depends. So you need, in that case, you need analytics. It can be the analytics you get in App Store Connect if you're selling your app in the App Store. It's not going to represent all your users, but it's probably going to represent a good portion of them, good enough for you to make an assessment. I would say if your adoption is fast enough, then you can do it, but I wouldn't do it like preemptively, like right now, bump the version to 14, and then when 14 ships in September, probably release your update and it's just for iOS 14, because you don't know what the adoption is going to be like. I think it has a good chance of being really good, probably better than 13, because 13 had like a reputation of not being particularly stable even before it was released, and it actually dropped a few devices. And 14 doesn't have that reputation, at least not so far, and it supports all devices that are currently supported by 13, which does have quite a good adoption right now. So I would say wait, and if you have an existing app, wait and see what the adoption is like in after like a month or two of it being released. If you're making a new app, especially if the new app has something about iOS 14 in it that it's going to use and it's going to be a big part of your app, I would say you're fine, like just release it for iOS 13. I wouldn't start a new app supporting a previous iOS release.
No, yeah, me neither.
Unless it's in a very specific market where that's like $1 million difference in terms of your revenue, like I mentioned. So yeah, I think for existing apps, it's a good idea to wait and see.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. I agree with the point that starting a new project, when I do that, I always use the latest operating system version, unless I'm like building it for a client that wants some kind of legacy support for some reason. But there is another thing here that I think can complicate things. We mentioned that there's all these new nice things in Swift UI and lots of other frameworks as well that require iOS 14. And some teams, I feel like they need to make a decision now whether or not they will start adopting those right now or whether or not they will wait. So that is kind of a gamble where you could say, okay, I want to use all of these new technologies and then I'm going to gamble that the adoption rate is going to be high enough so that I can actually ship this update maybe within a few weeks after iOS 14 was released and everything's going to be fine. So that is a gamble and you can decide whether or not you want to do that, whether or not you want to kind of stake your implementation on how iOS 14 is going to be received. But in general, I would agree with you, Rambo. I would try to wait as much as I can to see how things are going to play out before I make the decision to drop iOS 13, if I have an existing app.
Yeah, and if you're making a new app, just to clarify, and it's going to be shipped after iOS 14 is released, absolutely, just check the iOS 14 checkbox. I think it's a pop-up menu, actually.
Right. It's a pop-up menu checkbox.
Yeah, so definitely, I think that's the case. And you can also do a different approach, which is what I did for Chibi Studio last year because I didn't feel comfortable dropping iOS 12 support, which is to build new features only for the new OS, which is not that hard these days with the if available checks. It's actually become a lot easier. So you can like decide that every new feature you introduce is going to be just for the new system and the rest of the app can keep working and you can keep shipping bug fixes for previous versions, but the cool new stuff is only for the new system.
Yeah, that's definitely an approach you can take as well, especially if you have an app where the features are kind of separate from each other. So you can have those checks not scattered across the entire code base, but rather you can say like, here's this particular slice of the app is kind of, you know, hidden behind this particular version check.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm still not sure what I'm going to do about Chibi Studio. We're probably going to talk about this decision-making process more in future episodes as I work through it myself.
Yeah, that's going to be really interesting to hear your process during the beta period. And I'm also really looking forward to hear if you're going to adopt app clips and widgets and all those kind of things. I have an idea that you might, but you know, it's going to be interesting to hear how you're going to do that as well. So you're going to hear the story of me writing new apps and hopefully getting something out there and being able to ship some of these projects I've been working on for quite a while, and the update story from Rambo. But I'm sure, Rambo, that you will have some hidden apps in your sleeve as well that you might release in the fall as well.
Absolutely.
Awesome. So stay tuned for that in future episodes of Stack Trace. But that's it for this one. So I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, like we mentioned, we always love to hear your feedback. So if it's just that you like the show or there was something that you didn't like or something you want to give us feedback on, anything is really appreciated. You can tweet at us. I am at John Sundell and Rambo is at _insight on Twitter. And of course, if you want to share our show, that's always also really appreciated. And you can even keep using the hashtag #ShareStackTrace. We love to see when people do that as well. But that's it for this episode. So say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.